Just like 2 weeks ago, previous class, get your Bibles out. I'm going to be calling on volunteers to read the verses. Then I'll provide some commentary for what we're looking at. Last week, Dean finished off John chapter 6. And we're going to continue in the same vein. We're going to see Jesus and his conversations or his dialogue with different peoples, whether those be Jews, just laymen, or Pharisees, or with his apostles. And we'll be looking today, we'll be moving into chapter 7, and we'll be looking at that entire chapter going through verses 1 through 53, which covers the entire chapter. So to set the stage for this, let's get this. To set the stage for this, so after six chapters of John's Gospel, you should be beginning to see that much of this book is really a dialogue. It's a dialogue between Jesus and people in different locations, whether that's in Galilee or in Jerusalem or in Capernaum. What we're seeing is John records Jesus' interaction, which makes John unique, because we see a lot of conversations in John that we don't see anywhere else. So that's what brings out the character of John, of the Gospel of John, as being kind of unique among the Gospels. So in those different locations, we see Jesus and the people in general, like feeding of the 5,000. Jesus and the crowds that continually followed him, those, again, crowds following him because he was performing miracles that they were receiving some physicality from. Two different miracles we see where he feeds the multitude, and that precipitates or encourages the crowd to follow him around because they think they're going to get something from him. We see Jesus and his disciples, Jesus and his apostles, Jesus and individuals like Nicodemus or the Samaritan woman. We see Jesus and his enemies, the Jewish leadership, how they interact together with each other. Jesus and his disbelievers, those who are doing their best to tempt him, to try him, to make him slip up. And Jesus and those who come to him for healing. We see Jesus actually performing those miracles with different people. And those are recorded for us to know that Jesus was doing these things. And as John finishes up his book, these are the things that were recorded. But if he were to have been able to record everything that Jesus did, he doesn't think he could. There's enough books to fill what Jesus did. So, that being the case, we're getting just, I guess what you would say, the blood pressure reading of what Jesus did, you know, just that moment in time. And that's what we're seeing here in the Gospel of John, is just moments in time where we see what Jesus is doing with the people with whom he is interacting. So, what we're going to look at now is Jesus heading to Jerusalem. We're still probably about 6 months away from the crucifixion, so this isn't Jesus' triumphant entry into Jerusalem. In fact, what we're going to read here is Jesus doesn't want anybody to know he's there. So John recounts these dialogues in chapter 7 as they took place in Jerusalem, on the way to Jerusalem, or in the northern part of the country like Galilee and towns around the lake. So we're going to start before Jesus gets to Jerusalem with this chapter. And with the start of this chapter, we see a very rare dialogue between Jesus and his physical brothers, his family, that is, the children of Mary and Joseph that came after Jesus. His brothers are going to be talking to him about his ministry, and then we're going to see a dialogue between Jesus and the people themselves concerning Jesus. And then we know from other passages in Matthew and Mark that Jesus had both brothers and sisters. Mark even names the brothers, James, Joseph, Jude, and Simon. And John gives us a rare glimpse of what things were like for Jesus at home, and that is his physical home where he grew up. So let's start in chapter 7, and setting the stage for that, it had become very dangerous for Jesus in Jerusalem. He had been branded a troublemaker by the leadership and risked being arrested if he even went to Jerusalem. So the Feast of Booths, or the Feast of Tabernacles, was celebrated in October, and it was a time of celebration for the season's harvest of grain, fruit, and wine. It was also a commemorative feast remembering the escape from Egypt. So this is a time when people from all over the country are going to be coming into Jerusalem. The men were required to attend for the week-long festival. Thousands of booths or tents were erected outside the walls of the city of Jerusalem where the people would stay, hence the Feast of Booths. Okay? So that sets the stage for what we're looking at here. This is knowing that this is going on in Jerusalem, about to happen in Jerusalem. Now we're going to swing on up to Jesus' hometown in Galilee, and right before his brothers head down to Jerusalem, and before Jesus heads down to Jerusalem. I'm going to back up a little bit. Too far. So let's read the first couple of verses of the book of John. Can I get a volunteer for verses 1 and 2?
After these things, Jesus walked in Galilee, for he did not want to walk in Judea, because the Jews sought to kill him. Now the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles was at hand.
All right. Give me just a second here. I've got to organize one other thing that's not showing up on my screen here. Give me a second, I gotta get my notes to show up on the screen, so I'll be just a second here. Thanks, James. I appreciate that. So, we see Jesus walking in Galilee, like I mentioned. He was unwilling to walk in Judea because, like we had said, they were seeking to kill him, and it was a Feast of Booths. So we'll move on to verses 3 through 5. Can I get somebody to read verses 3 through 5?
His brothers therefore said to him, "Depart from here and go into Judea, that your disciples also may behold your works which you are doing. For no one does anything in secret when he seeks to be known publicly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." For not even his brothers were believing in him.
Okay, thank you very much. So we see here that John recounts a very personal moment between Jesus and his earthly brothers. The key here is that the brothers did not believe in Jesus. So their comments have to be taken in this light. Note the cycle of belief and disbelief showing up not only in this conversation, but we're going to see this in his conversation with the crowds and with the people who have... And you got to take into account here, just remember, Jesus has been in Jerusalem before, has talked to the crowds there before, has fed these crowds before. But this is a unique situation in that some of the people that are going to be in Jerusalem now have heard Jesus, have heard of him, have seen him, have been part of these crowds. But remember, this is people coming from all over Judea and Samaria to participate in this Feast of Booths. So there's a lot of people that are now in Jerusalem that are strangers to Jerusalem, who don't know or haven't been a part of Jesus' teachings, but they've heard about it. So we've got people who are commenting in the crowd about how Jesus is a phony. We got people who are commenting in the crowd that they've heard he's doing miracles. And so you got to keep in mind that you have this melange of people in Jerusalem right now, some who know Jesus, some who do not, and some who believe him and some who don't. So keep that in mind. It doesn't help that Jesus is having a real hard time here at home because his brothers pretty much say, you know, why don't you go prove yourself? Because no one does anything in secret when he's striving to be known publicly. I mean, what more does he have to do? He's healing people miraculously. He's fed 5,000 people with a lunch from a little boy. He's doing these things to be seen publicly, but even his family is not believing in him, even his brothers. And even though these men did not believe in him as the Messiah, they were quick to point out how he should conduct his ministry, giving him advice. His younger brothers, that's, you know, I love it when my younger brother gives me advice because, you know, especially when it's something he knows nothing about. their point makes sense. From our point of view, it sounds kind of logical. But if you want to be known, why waste your time and energy around here? Why? What are you doing in this sparsely populated Galilee? Go down where all the people are. Go where the action is what they're telling him. Jerusalem, especially while the crowds are there for the feast. And this being a required holiday, Jesus isn't going to miss the holiday just because he's afraid. But he doesn't want to go down there and cause a big ruckus. So we're going to see how he handles this situation with his brothers. So also note here that if you do these things, they had not even bothered to go to any of his public meetings. They had not witnessed any of his miracles that is recorded in the Bible that we're aware of, that his brothers had been there. They had only heard about Jesus, you know, secondhand. They're probably doing the family business, carpentry, whatever that happened to be. But they're not taking time out of their busy lives to go watch their brother and go listen to their brother bring the words of life. They don't believe and will not make the effort to find out, but they give him advice on how he should conduct his ministry. Again, you know, I love it that little brothers are giving advice about something they know nothing about. And perhaps they thought that if he turned out to be the great savior and king that the Jews believed the Messiah would be, they would receive his good favor. And we don't know that, but the fact that they're giving advice about something that they've never even witnessed is just kind of silly. We learn later that his brothers were converted after Jesus' resurrection. James became an elder and a leader of the Jerusalem congregation. So his brothers did come to belief, but at this time, not so much. Historians tell us that James was thrown from the city walls and stoned to death as a Christian martyr. And Jude went on to write the Epistle of Jude. So his brothers did believe in him, and they did have spiritual wisdom to impart upon us. But these first few verses in chapter 7 of the Gospel of John are not those nuggets of wisdom. So let's read verses 6 through 9. Can I get a volunteer for 6, 7, 8, and 9?
Jesus therefore said to them, "My time is not yet at hand, for your time is always opportune. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify of it, that its deeds are evil. Go up to the feast yourselves. I do not go up to this feast because my time is not yet fully come. And having said these things to them, Jesus stayed in Galilee.
Okay, so Jesus explains that the time to do what they want him to do, that is to show himself as the Messiah, is not here yet. It's not time for that yet. They think that going out among the crowds and doing miracles is the way to do this. And of course they would think that, but what has Jesus been doing? What have we been reading about in these last few chapters? And how well is he accomplishing that task? For many, they are coming into belief. But for many, they are ridiculing him. And that's not to stand in Jesus' way, but I think what we're seeing here is the ignorance of his little brothers. Jesus knows that dying on the cross and resurrecting, this is how he will manifest himself, and the time to do this is not yet at hand. He knows what his end is, and he knows where it will be. And we're going to see that time and time again, that people try to lay their hands on Jesus, if not for trying to make him forcibly, physically be their king, then it's trying to get him so they can stone him and kill him. It's just a whole gamut of emotions for people who are hanging around with Jesus. Their time, however, is already because they have no set mission. These little brothers, they are free to go to the festival. Go do this. This is something you're required to do once a year. They are free to return and go back to their jobs, and they are free to believe. And that's what Jesus is telling them. Go. I know it's time for you to go. I'm going to hang out here for a while. You don't need me to be the person that leads you to Jerusalem. Get over there and do it yourself. They can do these things because they are not under restriction, nor are they under attack. They are his brothers, but they are not being held accountable for Jesus' actions. They are not the ones who are speaking out, who are rocking the boat. Jesus' movements are limited because he is hated by those whom he is accused of sin, and he has done it openly to their faces in front of others, and especially the leadership, and that has made him enemies. His time is controlled by God because of his mission, and his brothers have no such restrictions on them. They can come and go as they please. God is not controlling their actions, whereas Jesus' mission is planned by God. And not just when Jesus came to the earth, this mission has been planned from the foundation of the world. This is a plan in motion set by God. So he encourages them to go, but tells them that he will not go for the purposes they suggested. And he won't go for that purpose. He's going to go for a different purpose. This does not mean that he will not go, rather that he will not go with their plan or their motives. So he tells his brothers, go. Don't worry about me. I'll be along shortly. I'll get there when it's time. Let's read verses 10 through 13. Can I get a volunteer for that?
However, after his brothers had left for the festival, he went also, not publicly, but in secret. Now at the festival, the Jewish leaders were watching for Jesus and asking, where is he? Among the crowds, there was widespread whispering about him. Some said, he is a good man. Others replied, no, he deceives the people. But no one
All right, so we get another little tidbit of what's going on in Jesus' life here and how he's viewed by others. So the scene changes to Jerusalem here now. We were up in Galilee, now we're back down here in Jerusalem. And there is no lack of controversy as we started this study in chapter 7. He's, I would say, afraid. There's nothing wrong with being afraid of what the leadership is trying to do to him. And he's trying to avoid the temptation for these people to try and kill him. He's not giving them the opportunity. So John shows that the people were divided in their opinion, and they were united in their common fear of the leadership and the leadership's opposition to Jesus. So we see some people believe him, some people don't, but they all fear the Pharisees and the Jewish leadership. And they're all afraid to be thrown out of the... the assembly. They're all afraid of what the leadership is going to do to them. And so they're speaking amongst themselves, but, you know, just kind of keeping it on the down low because they don't want to be accused of being a Jesus follower. They don't want the leadership coming down on them, and they don't want to be part of the controversy. So with Jesus now gone to Jerusalem, not with this triumphant entry on a horse or a mule, but just a quiet, secret entry into this Feast of Booths. The scene is set for several other dialogues that we're going to come across here now. And so the first one is going to be the dialogue between Jesus and the crowd. So in order to set the stage for this, you have to go back to verse 7 where Jesus gives the real reason for his opposition. He reveals the sins of the people, and they don't like that. They don't want to be told that they're doing something wrong. If you look at verse 7, it says, "The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify about it, that his deeds are evil." He is putting their sins out in the open for everybody to see. He's not letting them hide behind their excuses. And the people are upset about it. Some people are upset about it, especially the leadership. They don't want their dirty laundry aired in front of the crowds. They want him to conform and to follow their guidance. And Jesus is unwilling to do that because they are sinners, as he has accused them. And in his dialogue with the people, the leaders, he will do this very thing. He's going to call them sinners to their faces. He's going to reveal their hypocrisy. And again, they want to kill him for it. He does this by responding to their various charges that they're going to make against him. So let's look at some of those things. The first charge is that he's incompetent. So let's read verses 14 and 15. Can I get a volunteer for that? So the people are impressed with his teaching, but they're questioning his credentials. So if he could not show proper credentials in having been trained in one of the rabbinical schools or at the feet of Gamaliel like Paul was, how credible could his teaching be? And the Jewish leaders asked the crowd this rhetorical question in an effort to discredit him publicly because... You know, ever since he was 12, and he was astounding people with his knowledge of the law and the prophets, they don't know what to do with him. And we're going to see later on that even when they send the temple guard to get him, they're just astounded by the way he speaks, by what he says. They don't know what to do. How can we bring this guy in? Because we've never heard a man speak like this before. So they charge him with just being incompetent. And I think Jesus has shown enough knowledge and wisdom in his discussions with these people for them to know that this isn't just some wacky person who's got a demon in him. He actually understands the law and the prophets. He understands these people's beliefs. He sees through their hypocrisy, and they're having a hard time understanding how this unlearned man, the son of a carpenter, could have all this knowledge and wisdom. So in verses 16 through 19, let's read that. Verses 16 through 19.
So Jesus answered them and said, "My teaching is not mine, but his who sent me. If anyone is willing to do his will, he will know the teaching whether it is of God or whether I speak for myself. He who speaks from himself seeks his own glory. But he who is seeking the glory of the one who sent him, he is true, and there is no unrighteousness in him. Did not Moses give you the law, and yet none of you carries out the law? Why do you seek to kill me?
All right. So Jesus is going to retort against this this accusation that he's not trained enough to be teaching like this with three different points. He's going to say the teaching that he gives is not his own. The teaching is of God who sent him. So listen to it. This isn't my words, this is God's words. He's going to say, number two, anyone who claims to know God will do God's will, and by this will be proven to be legitimate. So basically, you fail this test because you misinterpret God's will given to you by Moses, and you're trying to kill me for it. And then he finally says, those who speak their own authority seek their own glory. Those who speak with God's authority seek to glorify God, which is what Jesus is doing. He's glorifying God in everything that he's teaching. He's not glorifying himself. He's not doing it to earn money. He's not doing it to earn power. He's doing it to be a shining light that people will follow. So the implication on this one is that it is evident who received the glory from his ministry and who received the glory and honor when the Jewish leaders taught and practiced their religion, which is not, as he accuses them, what they were taught from Moses. It is not the law, because they aren't following the law. He tells us elsewhere in the Gospels that they carry out every jot and tittle, but they neglect the weightier matters of the law. They tithe cumin and mustard and mint, but they neglect orphans and widows. He's showing them their hypocrisy, and they're getting mad about it. They're getting upset because, again, he's airing their dirty laundry. The second charge, let's read verse 20.
The crowd answered, "You have a demon."
So now he's demon-possessed. So this time it's the crowd who voices an opinion about Jesus' accusation of the Jewish leaders. So in effect, they're saying, "You're crazy. How can you say that our leaders are trying to kill you?" Well, because they've been trying to kill him since he started teaching. But like I said, remember the conglomeration of the people that are in this crowd right now. Some of the people have seen this. Many have not. Many of the people who are in this crowd don't know that the Jewish leaders want Jesus dead. They may have heard that he's stirring up the hornet's nest, but they haven't seen them try to put their hands on Jesus. And so they think that he's just nuts. Our Jewish leaders wouldn't try to kill anybody. So do not forget that most of these people are pilgrims to Jerusalem for the feast. So they're not aware of everything that's been going on here locally. And they're having a hard time believing that their leaders would do anything like this. Verses 21 through 24. Volunteer for that.
Jesus answered and said to them, "I did one deed, and you all marvel. On this account, Moses has given you circumcision, not because it was from Moses, but from the fathers. And on the Sabbath, you circumcise a man. If a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath, that the law of Moses may not be broken, you are angry with me because I made an entire man well on the Sabbath. Do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment."
All right. So we see Jesus referring to him healing a man on the Sabbath. So keep that in mind. And then keep in mind the fact that it was the law of Moses that every male born had to be circumcised on the eighth day. And if that eighth day fell on Sabbath, so be it. You circumcised on the Sabbath. That being the case, he's bringing this up. Well, isn't circumcision work? Well, yeah. Are you allowed to do it? Absolutely. So the Lord does not even address their charge. He just shows by his unfailing insight that he's not crazy or possessed at all. Again, he pulls out his knowledge of the law. He explains that the charge that he made has been made against the leaders in his previous statement. And his reference to a miracle is the one where he healed the lame man on the Sabbath, and when he was accused of sinning because he healed on the Sabbath, because it was considered work, so he was working on the Sabbath. This was also the cause for great anger and violence directed toward him by the Jewish leaders. This idea that you can't perform a miracle on the Sabbath because it violates the law flies in the face of what Jesus is telling them, that the law required some things be done on the Sabbath. And so when he's doing God's will be done any day. It doesn't matter what day it is. So in effect, what he shows is his miracle is in a perfect accord with Moses. Even when done on the Sabbath, he says the law on circumcision given by Moses, but originating long before Moses through Abraham, commanded that each male child be circumcised on the eighth day after his birth. All right. So this was done even if the eighth day fell on a Sabbath. And since circumcision was a sign that this person was blessed by God by being included as part of the chosen people, not by birth, but by obedience to circumcision, this ritual of blessing did not violate the Sabbath, even when it was performed on that day. And in the same way, the healing of the lame man was done on the Sabbath. It was not wrong because he was receiving a special blessing only God could give. Even if it was done on the Sabbath, it was acceptable because, like circumcision, a person was being blessed by God. Nothing wrong with that. This was not a work of man. It was a blessing from God, and he chose to give it on the Sabbath. Teaching these people that there are things that are okay to do on the Sabbath. Not that it's going to matter for much longer anyway, because in the next 60 to 70 years, the Sabbath is going to be gone. At least in any way, shape, or form that can be traced back legally in blood heritage. And Jesus encourages them to judge correctly, to see the utter rightness of what he had done. It was a righteous event. There was nothing wrong with it. The appearance was what the Jewish leaders were trying to make of it. He is saying, judge it for what it really is. God's will being done on the Sabbath, which is what the Sabbath is all about, obeying God. So this dialogue is going to be, continue between Jesus and the crowd. So they're going to charge him with being a pretender. So let's read verses 25, 26, and 27. Can somebody read those for us?
Therefore, some of the people of Jerusalem were saying, is this not the man whom they are seeking to kill? And look, Jesus is speaking publicly, and they are saying nothing to him. The rulers do not really know that this is the Christ, do they? However, we know where this man is from, but whenever the Christ may come, no one knows where he is from.
All right. So again, and we're going to see this more than once, where people accuse Jesus of not being the Messiah because he's not from Bethlehem, from the city of David. Where was Jesus born? He wasn't raised in Bethlehem. He was raised in Nazareth, but he was born in Bethlehem just as was prophesied. So, again, people just overlooking the facts of his situation. So Jesus was speaking to, again, the pilgrims, people who had come from afar, the out-of-towners, but now the citizens of Jerusalem speak up testifying on their own, more authoritative, more inside information as we've been talking about, and these people know that the leaders want Jesus dead. So you kind of see this back and forth here where it's the people, but there's the people who know and there's the people who don't know. There's the people who live around and in Jerusalem and there's the people who live not around and in Jerusalem and other places who just aren't privy to what's been going on here. So they feel, more concrete reasons for denying him and casting him out as a mere pretender. They say the rulers, the leaders, do not believe him. Well, we can't believe somebody who the rulers don't believe in. He says they want to kill him, but here he is speaking openly. He thinks himself, he thinks too highly of himself. You know, he's got a target on his back. He's trying to think that he's the person that everybody wants to either be a part of or try to kill. So they're accusing him of being this great pretender. And we know that the scriptures teach that the Messiah will come from this area, our area, Bethlehem, which is near Jerusalem in the district of Judea, not from some hick town in northern Galilee. But again, we know that Jesus was born in Bethlehem. And he was raised in Nazareth, you know, where in that sparsely populated Galilee area. But that doesn't mean that he wasn't qualified as a Messiah. So they dismiss the pilgrims as being without proper information, and Jesus as being from the wrong place. So this is their reason for disbelieving. They, of course, have completely discounted the great miracle that he performed on the Sabbath, and so many miracles before that. So, like an elephant in the room, nobody wants to acknowledge the miracles that he's doing everywhere. So many that they can't be accounted for, John tells us. Maybe he was doing so many that they had become commonplace. Again, dialogue with the crowd. Jesus ignores their ignorance. Let's read verses 28 and 29. All right, so Jesus is using a play on words here. In modern speech, he would be saying, so you think you know me. So you think you know where I'm from. You do not even know what you think you know. You do not even know what you think you know, is what he's telling them. He's telling them, you're ignorant. I am from God. I know this because I know him. And you do not know this because you don't know God. You've ignored him. You've been following leaders who ignore God, who ignore the law, who ignore what they're supposed to be teaching you. So this dialogue between Jesus and the crowd, the citizens, the pilgrims, the leaders, they're all divided. So verses 30 through 32, I'm going to read that one. So they were seeking to arrest him, and yet no one laid a hand on him because his hour had not yet come. But many of the crowd believed in him, and they were saying, when the Christ comes, he will not perform more signs than those which this man does, will he? The Pharisees heard the crowd whispering these things about him, and the chief priests and Pharisees sent officers to arrest him. So we see, you know, these people who are saying, you know, they're not going to arrest him. What do you mean arrest you? And then, lo and behold, they're trying to arrest him. So they're upset now. Even the citizens are siding with their leaders in wanting to seize him, but their confusion prevents any action. This is just people arguing and whispering and not knowing what to do. This is because God will not allow any action to come against Jesus until it's his time. So God controls the situation. The crowds and the pilgrims assess the situation and realize that they cannot dismiss the great miracle that Jesus had done, no matter what the others think. The Pharisees, seeing the situation beginning to unravel, joined forces with their natural antagonists, the priests, in order to stop the momentum that is beginning to form behind Jesus. They give official orders to have Jesus arrested by the temple guard. They cannot go in and haul him away, fearing further trouble. They will seek an opportunity in the future to do so. So now Jesus is going to respond to the leaders. And I'm running seriously out of time. Which is fine. That's all this technical stuff that I had to do. So he responds to the leaders. He says in verse 33 and 34, for a little longer I'm going to be with you, and then I'm going to be with him, he who sent me. You will seek me, and you won't find me. You cannot go where I am going. And they don't understand that. They say, where does this man intend to go? He does not intend to go to the dispersion, you know, out into the nether regions where the Jews have gone away and teach the Greeks, does he? And what is the statement that he said, you will seek me and will not find me, and where I'm going you cannot come? He's confusing the heck out of the crowd now. They have no idea what to think of this guy. They're confused. They think he's afraid of capture, that he's going to run away, that he's going to go out to the diaspora. By their answer and their speculation, they prove they do not understand all the words that he is speaking. They are completely confused and confounded by what Jesus is saying. And we're going to see that this dialogue continues for the rest of the chapter. Jesus makes a final plea in verses 37 through 39. And then as the chapter winds up, we're going to see that Jesus summarizes this entire episode in verses 40 through 44. So, that reads, some of the people, therefore, were, after they heard these words, were saying, this truly is a prophet. Others were saying, this is the Christ. But others were saying, surely the Christ is not coming from Galilee, is he? Has the scripture not said that the Christ comes from the descendants of David and from Bethlehem, the village where David was? So a dissension occurred among the crowd because of it. Again, Jesus knew this was going to happen, which is why he was trying to avoid this. And some of them wanted to arrest him, but no one laid hands on him. And then we're going to see that the leaders try and take advantage of this. The officers came, the chief priests, and said to him, why do you not bring him? This is what we talked about earlier. The guard said, never has a man spoken this way. We can't take him. Have you heard this guy? Have you heard what he says? So they failed to arrest him, just being dazzled by what he says. And the Pharisees, of course, get upset with this. And as we read through verses 47 and through 53, the Pharisees then replied, have you been led astray too? Not one of the rulers or the Pharisees has believed in him, has he? But the crowd that does not know the law is accursed. Nicodemus, the one who came before him and the one of them, said to them, our law does not judge the person unless it first hears from him and knows what he is doing, does it? They answered him and said, you are not from Galilee as well, are you? Examine the scriptures and see that no prophet arises out of Galilee. And everybody went home. So this idea that Jesus is from Galilee, from Nazareth, and not from Bethlehem, they're using every single opportunity that they can to try and discredit Jesus. And Jesus is just going to continue to build on this as we move into the future chapters. Sorry that was so hurried. We've made it through the seventh chapter. I would encourage you to read through it again if you get a chance. This dialogue is important because Jesus is going to use it again and again and again as he defends himself against the leaders who are trying to discredit him. Thank you.